The Digital Banking Podcast is powered by Typhoon. Typhoon is a dramatically better digital banking provider. Our appeal is unique. We collaborate closely with our customers and the banking ecosystem in an open approach coupled with a powerful user experience that helps get things done. On our podcast, you will hear how digital banking plays a leading role for community-minded financial institutions from the unique perspectives of our industry expert guests.
You know, your podcast hasn't officially made it until there's ads in it. But this is one you're not going to want to skip past. And, well, if you do, feel free to hit that fast forward 15 seconds button twice. Ever wonder what gives me my energy and enthusiasm during these podcasts? You know, outside of my relentless desire to learn about, connect, share, and build up community FIs and their mission to support the communities they serve, it's coffee and lots of it. Now, you want to know what's better than your regular old coffee? How about donating $5 to the Children's Miracle Network Hospitals through Credit Unions for Kids every time you purchase high-quality, ethically sourced coffee that also provides living wages to coffee farmers? So if you want to listen to this episode with epic levels of caffeine-induced focus and help kids in need, head to javaforkids.org to learn more and buy a bag or 10. Thanks. Welcome to another episode of the Digital Banking Podcast. We have a very special episode for you today featuring two guests. I have Matt Iverson Camello, the CEO and founder of MoneyMap, and Sid Ratkiewicz, a behavioral researcher at the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University. One of the things that stood out to me from early conversations with Matt was his genuine servant's heart, which will no doubt come out in this episode. Just the ways that he thinks about things and the way that he communicates truly demonstrates it. Going back to taking a gap year between high school and college to learn to meditate in Nepal, to his time spent fighting for and advocating for human rights, Matt has really put his money where his mouth is in terms of living up to this desire to help and make an impact. A comment that he made to me in passing really stuck with me. He said, "I want to continuously figure out how to use the skills I have to do better for our world and the people in it." Matt loves to connect with people and nature. So when he's looking for some time alone with his thoughts, you can find him out running the trails of the Bay Area where he lives. I had to chuckle, though, when he made the comment because of how casually he said, "Yeah, I'll just, you know, go do 10 or 12 miles." So note to self, don't go for a casual run with Matt. It will be anything but casual. Sid also gave me a good laugh in our intro call by saying, "I used to say I'm a shy extrovert, then realized, nope, I'm a full-blown extrovert." Being a behavioral researcher, Sid is fascinated to the core about what makes people tick and what's going on in their heads. Also, being fascinated by process improvement means Sid has found a passion in finding ways to make complex processes simpler and aligning the processes to the people instead of trying to get people to align to the process. Looking for ways to see people for who they are and not who we want them to be. Removing cognitive biases and creating processes that actually work for real people. Sid has taken a keen interest in these concepts and passions specifically when it comes to how people think and approach managing finances and the impacts that making those easier for people to do well could have. The financial world can be very opaque to someone not raised up in it, and we're going to talk a lot about that in today's episode. Sid loves to also use these learnings to create community and foster relationships in both the professional and personal worlds. You two, I am super excited for this podcast. I've been really itching to get this one on the books because I think, you know, folks who've listened to our podcast in the past have heard me talk about how fascinated I am by just the behavioral side of people and what makes people tick. But it's not my background of expertise. So anytime I get somebody that is their background and expertise, I get really excited to talk to. So thank you so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you both.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
So I want to start off by just, I guess, starting the conversation around why is this topic even important? Like, why do we even need to be talking about the quote unquote behavioral science behind the way that people think about and manage money? I know that's a crazy loaded question, and we're going to spend a lot of time kind of diving into that, but maybe just at the very start, Sid, do you want to kick us off by talking just a little bit about why that's actually an important topic in the first place?
Sure. Yeah. Thinking about this question is something that we've only really been doing for the past, 30, 40 years. And it's a real deviation from traditional economics to think about, how do people deviate from what they're supposed to do, right? We have so many theories. We have such a strong understanding of what makes sense economically, what decisions make sense for people to make. And then we see people very, very predictably deviating from what we think makes sense from traditional economic theory. So this field of behavioral economics came about to try to no longer ignore that very, very real reality that, we very consistently deviate from what we're supposed to do. And rather than ignore that, we want to try to design for that. We want to try to study, what are these cognitive biases? How do they show up in our financial decision making? And how can we actually address them within the design and creation of products?
Yeah, that's a great answer, because I think, we were talking about this even before recording, right? That it's amazing how little information we get as a society, even in America, for financial education and literacy and just setting up the foundations of success. And then we expect people to deviate from what they may have just learned or picked up as behavior over the years. Mm-hmm. You know, sure. And I'll make the obnoxiously, aside kind of correlation. It's like, we all know we should eat healthy, right? Mm-hmm. But you're hungry and you're busy and you're driving past McDonald's and you're like, a Big Mac sounds phenomenal right now. Like, I think there's just, a lot of different ways that we see in our lives. Like, sometimes we maybe know the right thing to do, we just don't do it. But then there's a whole nother level of, I don't even know the right thing to do. And I think that's what we see even a lot of in the financial space, right? I mean, a lot of times I don't even know where to start.
Yeah, I think if you're really, really lucky, you might have some sort of financial education class in high school. When you're a teenager, before you're really making any type of financial decisions. And then if you happen to be born in the right family, you might get some instruction from your parents. But, especially in the U.S., we really don't have a systemic way to catch people up to speed on, what we call financial education, on making the right financial decisions. And then even the lucky few who do get those lessons, and as you mentioned, are not necessarily going to follow through. We in the lab, we like to say that nobody wakes up and says, today I'm going to make decisions that make me poorer and less healthy. And yet, we see that occurring again and again. And part of that is also that, the system is really, really set up to tempt people down paths that make it easier to spend money and make it easier to rack up high interest debt and then make it really hard to reach financial stability.
I want to come back to that, what you just ended with here in a second. But before I do, you made me think of this meme that goes around every year around this time, around tax time. I'm sure you've seen it, but it's something like, I'm really glad that in high school, they taught me algebra instead of how to do my taxes. It's really come in handy this parallelogram season. Right? And you're like, okay, maybe there's some opportunity for improvement there. But yeah, like you're saying, I mean, it's just, I think that there's left a lot left on the table in terms of just even basic education around finances. Matt, before we go too far, I'd love to get your thoughts.
Yeah. It's interesting in listening to Sid, I'm reminded that also this information degrades fairly rapidly, right? And that people can learn new things about their personal finances, but being able to access that information when they need to, mentally is hard. It's like how many of us really remember what we learned in physics in high school? For me, it's a long time ago, but even then, right? Like there's not much access there for me. And so I think that's an interesting way of thinking about it. And then also just like the importance of these issues for people's everyday life, right? Like the access to credit that's affordable and not digging, not having to dig yourself deeper into a hole in order to just cover rent. So I think that there's there's really, and I know that the Center for Advanced Hindsight works a ton on these issues, just around like how do you help people who are traditionally disadvantaged in the economic system, right?
Yeah, I want to kind of go down two paths that you both have brought up now. So the first is there's this big divide, and there's a bunch of gray area in between, right? Of just how much financial education people get in the very beginning, right? And then on top of that, we also live in a society, what you were kind of finishing with, Sid, that almost rewards bad behavior, right? Like we're very incentivized. Go on social media, right? It's like, hey, spend a bunch of money on all these things, and we're going to try and make it so easy for you to spend money on these things. And don't worry about it. You don't even have the money. It's cool. We'll buy now, pay later. We'll give you a high interest credit card. You know, just that's tomorrow's problem. Like tomorrow, Sid can deal with that. Today's Sid can get a new car, you know?
Okay.
So with kind of those two thoughts in mind, you know, how do you, I guess, look at that as a researcher? And how do you kind of uncover, and what are some of the things that you've uncovered about people's behavior in those senses?
Yeah. I think the first thing that we understand is you mentioned tomorrow Sid versus today Sid. We do a lot of thinking and at the center about tomorrow you versus you today. And we know that people are really, really, really bad at what we call effective forecasting and sort of imagining what it will be like to be tomorrow Sid. It is really, really easy to imagine how we'll feel if we, you know, right now, as we click that add to cart button. A lot harder to really imagine how we'll feel once that first payment comes due. So a lot of what we do in the lab is try to address that problem of bringing future use needs to light, making them more salient, making them more addressable in the moment, and also changing the motivations for current use so that they align well with future you, if that makes sense. So rather than trying to remind yourself how you're going to feel when that payment comes due, we do a lot of thinking about how can we create motivation in the moment? How can we make it feel good in the moment for you to do the right thing for yourself financially?
That's super interesting. I was thinking about, you had made a comment, I'd made a note, I wanted to get your like longer form on this because you had just dropped some interesting nuggets to me before we started recording about just habit change and habit formation. And, you know, I have a really silly personal example of that. How do I remind myself about how is future me going to think about this? And it's my Christmas lights. So my wife and I go pretty hard for Christmas lights every year. And it's only gotten worse over the years. And every year when Christmas is over and I go to take them down, now me wants to rip them all down as fast as possible because it's December in Oregon. It's probably cold and raining and gross, and I don't want to be doing it. And it's just like the wah, 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 the season ending. So now me wants to just rip them all down, throw them in a box in a ball, and deal with it later. And instead, I remind myself that in 11 months, I'm going to be really pissed off at myself when I open this box and find this jumble of Christmas lights. So I take them down meticulously, I wrap them all up, I label them, say this goes to this bush, this goes to this tree, this wraps around this pole. It's a total pain in the neck. And every year, the next year, I open that box and I'm like, hey, I'm proud of old you. Good job, man. You did good, you know? And but in all seriousness, like I use that example even in other areas of my life where I say, hey, is this going to be a Christmas lights moment? Like, are you going to be pissed off at yourself next year that you just ripped the lights down and threw them in the box? So how do you look at just habit change and habit formation around trying to get people to think about future them differently?
Totally. Yeah. I think that first, good for you. That is a very rare skill to be able to think of yourself.
Well, I'm not saying that I'm great at it in other areas. I'm just saying I've nailed it on the Christmas lights finally.
The Christmas lights are good. Yeah. It must be really cold when you're putting them on to get enough motivation to want to set yourself up well in the future. Yeah. One of the things that I think about in the center is, you know, that example suggests a lot of self-control, right? It suggests a lot of being willing to do something hard in the present, label all of your Christmas lights, tuck them away meticulously to get a bigger gain in the future. And we find that overall, people are pretty unwilling to do that. So, you know, for example, if I offer you a choice between $5 today or $20 in a week, you're likely to take the $5 today. Even more so if I offer you a choice between $5 today and $100 in a year, you're really unlikely to want to take that bigger later reward. And we find that this is even more true when you get to populations that are disadvantaged in some way or have some reason to not necessarily trust in a stable future. So, you know, one of the complexities of this work is that sometimes it makes sense to take the $5 today. Sometimes we don't have a year to wait to get the bigger later reward. And sometimes it feels really, really good to get the $5 today. And, you know, we've had a really long day at work and we, you know, don't want to be out in the cold taking down the Christmas lights and carefully putting them away when we just have so little left in our emotional reserves. So that's when we start to think about, you know, not reminding people, you know, how are you going to feel in a year, but thinking about how can we make it as easy as possible to get those Christmas lights down? How can we make it as fun and as engaging as possible to do the right thing in the moment? So what we might do is, rather than remind you, how are you going to feel in a year? We might think about, you know, can we make this a lovely ritual? Can we put on music? Can we, you know, take photographs? Can we create some sort of situation around this that actually makes it intrinsically enjoyable or that makes it easier in the moment? Can we, you know, deliver you a Christmas light teardown kit that removes some of the decision making, removes some of the cognitive barriers from trying to do the right thing? And I think that that's true, you know, with financial decision making. It's especially true when we think about financial advice, which is a particularly thorny area where someone's telling you, you know, you need to do the right thing to, you know, have some sort of gain far in the future when it might be really, really difficult to get that motivation to do it today.
Well, and that's something, Matt, you mentioned to me that was really interesting is, you know, on top of that, people don't give great advice. So that's been one of the areas that you've been kind of looking at a lot, right? Is not only are people not getting advice at all, but a lot of times when they are, it's poor advice, right? Yeah. It's somebody saying, oh, well, you know, this works for my financial situation, so you should do it my way. And they have no understanding of what this person's, you know, personal financial situation looks like and if their methodology is going to actually work when applied over here.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think that the idea of delivering personalized financial advice in a way that scales and helps people, you know, you still have to spend time, right, with somebody, but is there a way that we can, and this is where Sid and I worked together on a randomized controlled trial that Duke organized around that question of like, how do we, are there different things that we can test, right? Does framing matter a lot? Like, or is how the advice delivered, does that matter? And I think there were some really, for me, there were some really non-intuitive learnings from that. And one of the things that was interesting around just like being able to give good advice. And I think all the people who are participating in this RCT in the randomized controlled trial were certified financial planners. So they had a pretty strong background in, you know, broad personal finance. But what we saw from the participants, the folks that were getting advice, and I think we had about 3,000 people run through it, was that those folks had a strong preference for asynchronous advice. Like we put them in different conditions, right? In half gut meeting condition where they would meet and talk with somebody and talk about their advice or their situation and get some advice. And the others would basically do a survey and have messaging support. And for me, like we saw like, I think it was like over 1 in 4 people switched out of a meeting condition into an asynchronous condition. Now, this was a predominantly low to moderate income demographic. But what I just didn't expect was like people would have a strong preference not to have that conversation. And then I think as we started to think about it, like, oh, I guess, you know, this is a difficult conversation to have, right? Like, how do you, and partly it's like, how do you give them the good advice? But then how do you get them to want to have that conversation in the first place, right? Like to feel comfortable enough to be able to connect with somebody that they don't know, right? And they don't have much of a pre-existing condition. They have a pre-existing relationship with, right? And so this is where, you know, I think a good advice, even if you can give really good advice, like how do you deliver it in a way that actually helps people in a way that they want to receive that advice, right? We generally think like, oh, we need to have, and I'm involved with a nonprofit, a pro bono financial planning platform. And the financial planner is like, we have to talk to everybody, right? And it's like, well, like you may, maybe the goal is to talk to everyone, but maybe not start there, right? Like maybe start with like, hey, you can start to message with your advisor and just like start a rapport, answer some questions around what your financial goal is or goals are, like why that's important to you, get a little more context and start with some easy advice that are some quick wins for people and then be able to move them further into that cycle of like, oh, okay, now I'm ready to go deeper, right? But building that trust, delivering empathy, like those are all really things that humans are really good at and technology is not really as good at. So like, how do you lever that up a little bit to get that good advice to people in a way that they want to receive it, they're comfortable, and that you can build on?
It's interesting you say that. I have a mentor that gave me a piece of advice once forever ago, and I think it needs some tweaks, but it's always stuck with me. And he said, there's a core group of people that you should just never, ever lie to. And he said, it was your doctor, your attorney, and your tax person, and your spouse. And and that always kind of stuck with me. But what was funny and why I mentioned that is I had a guest on the podcast a while ago who referenced, I want to say it was a book, and I hope I don't get the title wrong, but I think it was something like People Don't Lie to the AI. The point that was made was, you know, you may go into the doctor and on the intake form, it asks you like, how many alcoholic beverages do you consume a week? And maybe you say, oh, you know, what, like, what's okay? Well, you know, I don't want to completely lie and say zero, you know, but like, if I say I, you know, chug 6 bottles of wine before I start my day, like they're probably going to get mad at me. So, you know, I think two is reasonable. We'll put 2, right? And then you talk to the doctor and they're like, hey, is there any concerns that you want to talk to me about? And you're like, no. And then you go home and you Google, hey, and you put in exactly how much you drink. Is this too much for a person to drink in a week? Right. And it's because it's a scary, like, personal topic that even with somebody like your doctor, you may feel uncomfortable having that conversation, but you have no problem typing it into Google. Right. So I just thought that was really interesting when you were talking about, like, in some of your research, what you found to be counterintuitive to what you expected was people were actually seemed to be more comfortable having the asynchronous communication than actually sitting down and telling somebody, yeah, no, my finances are totally screwed up and I need help.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, to really, really underscore how surprising this was, you know, defaulting someone into a setting is one of the strongest tools that we have in behavioral science. We know that if you are given a default, you are very, very, very likely to stick with that default. So, you know, when we defaulted people into having this first meeting over the phone or having it via a survey, we saw 207 participants actually went through the effort of switching over from having a call to taking that asynchronously via survey. So 207 people made the effort to switch out of their default, which is already a very, very strong finding, 207 out of about 700 people. In contrast, wow. You got 7 people who switched from a survey to a call.
Oh, wow.
So not nobody, but 1% of the total who were defaulted into a survey said, actually, I'd rather talk to someone on the phone.
Sydney.
And what we found was that, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
What we found was, you know, I think that this is partly due to the trust aspect. This is partly due to the fact that especially for, you know, the people who are seeking out financial coaching in this setting tended to be LMI, tended to have some pretty significant financial challenges that may be pretty difficult to talk to with a stranger. So trust is a really big part of it. Another really big part of it is the ability to feel like you're taking action right away. So it sounds a little counterintuitive with the asynchronicity aspect, but one really, really great thing about starting people off with a survey, starting people off with something that they can do on their own without someone on the other side of the phone or on the other side of the chat box, is that they feel like they're making progress right away. So we also found that, you know, around 80% of the people in the survey condition, we gave them a choice. Would you like to complete the survey right away or would you like to wait?
They found that about 80% of people wanted to take it right away. And then 98% of people who took it right away completed it.
Oh,
this
wow.
is astronomically high when you think about, you know, first meetings for financial coaching or similar. Usually you get show rates of around 20% if you're lucky, 20 to 30%. So to have 98% of people actually taking that first step is really, really huge.
Sid, do you think that that has something to do with what we were talking about in your intro of just even simplifying a process? So just making it, I'm just thinking about it for myself personally, right? Like if I look at my day, I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to schedule this time with an advisor to call. I've got to come to this meeting, you know, probably prepared, and I don't want to sound like an idiot. And I'm also a little bit nervous just to share with this complete stranger my, you know, personal financial position. Oh, wait, I can Absolutely. Just take this survey whenever and I can knock it out. And it's kind of just like laid out for me step by step what to do. Do you think there's some of that involved in that kind of behavioral element?
It's removing so many variables, so many barriers. You don't have to find yourself a quiet time. You don't have to remember to pick up that phone or, you know, remember to click on that link to access that survey. You don't have to immediately feel that vulnerability of another person on the phone, but you still have that sense that a real human is going to be, you know, contributing to your financial advice. So I think that's a huge part of it, as well as is just making it easier to take that first step.
Matt, when you were doing some of this research, I was looking over some of the just research paper stuff that you sent me before the podcast. One of the things I thought was really interesting looking through that was that there was also a pretty direct correlation in getting people to go through the process and actually deriving positive outcomes out of it, right? And actually making changes, which I don't know if this is similar to you, maybe based on your earlier comment, it is. Like, I found that kind of counterintuitive because I would have expected, again, just going back to the, you know, like we know we should eat healthier. Like a lot of people seem to respond well to having, you know, a quote unquote, you know, fitness coach or health coach that is like holding them accountable to eating good foods, making sure they go to the gym, like providing that motivation. I would have thought that having somebody like an actual person holding you accountable would have driven higher results, but you actually found higher results of accomplishing, like making an impact when it was done through the asynchronous model.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was another thing that was, it was a 2x2 study. We looked at whether it was a meeting or survey, asynchronous condition, and the framing. And I think the framing, Sid, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was self-efficacy versus accountability. So self-efficacy being, you know, you've got this, I'm here for you, and accountability, like, hey, I'm your financial planner or your advisor, like I'm going to be checking in and making sure that you do these things. And so what performed best was the asynchronous self-efficacy condition. And really which was also really surprising, like that to me, it was just like you, Josh, like I just sort of expected that if there's a person involved and they're, you know, and there was a person asynchronously, right? But if there was, and you can leverage that person and scale them up with video welcome messages and personalization of the text messages that go out to the person who's getting the advice, as well as emails and messages. So there's a bunch that you can do to personalize and scale up that individual. And I think that's really important for being able to make advice more broadly available to lots of people who need it and can benefit from it. So that was just part of the system, and that was for all the conditions. And we changed the messages. Like, we spent a ton of time. I remember Sid remembers, I'm sure, and Allison, who was also working on the project at the time, like they went through and they like audited all the messages. Like, and this is like, I don't know, well over 100, probably like close to 200, 250 maybe. And they looked at and they reframed certain aspects of those messages to fit with the framing of what we were trying to do, accountability or self-efficacy. But ultimately, yeah, the folks that got the asynchronous advice made more progress. And what was also a little bit rewarding is that when we had started developing this type of intervention with Dan Ariely and the folks that Sid works with, that was really the idea. Was we sort of started with this idea of, hey, we've gotten really good at getting people through a signup flow, right? We can get them through a signup flow, but getting them to do something is really hard, right? This intention action gap, right? Like, I intend to do better, but I intend to do better tomorrow, right? So like, how do we get people to intend to do better today? And I think that's that was really what we were shooting for, is like, how do we develop interventions that reduce friction, that get people into a planning process, feel like they're making some progress, and then help amplify that through timely nudges. So I think it's John Lynch at, is that right? Said he's at University of Colorado Boulder. Yeah. So he'd done some research, and I attended an event that Dan put on. I think it was at Intuit here in the Bay Area. And he was talking about this idea of just-in-time messages, right? And this is not anything new to any of us, right? But this idea also that our memory of what we might have learned around our personal finances will degrade over time. So like, we need to just be able to hit people with the right message at the right time, when we know that, you know, if they've got a deadline coming up to set up that emergency savings account, right? Like, we need to remind them, hey, your deadline's coming up, or it just passed. How can I help, right? And this idea of being able to automate certain messages, but it also leads back to a real person where you can have this conversation and you can get the help that you need in a way that's timely.
This kind of comes back to one of the kind of forks we were talking about earlier of, you know, it's very obvious there's a large wage gap, or not wage gap, sorry, wealth gap in America. There's also a large wage gap, but there's a large wealth gap in America. And I mean, there's umpteen million factors that go into that we're not going to get into today, but it's very obvious that one of the big factors of that is just education of, one, how to stay out of the system, Sid, you referenced earlier, right? Of this very incentivized to take on high interest debt and, you know, spend money on things that you shouldn't be, making poor financial decisions, and poor advice, like Matt, you brought up earlier. And then coupling that with just, you know, lack of education and training for people. And so now, taking some of this research that you have done, you know, how are you looking at, you know, Sid, you mentioned the, you know, bringing this at scale, right? Like, how do you think about starting to personalize at scale and bring to people that necessarily have not had access to good financial training before? Like, how do you think about starting to create programs around that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think that that's something that people in the world of financial advice kind of struggle with, in my experience, because we really, really, really want to think of everyone as being unique, as being, as their circumstances, as being very, very specific to them. And that is true. And we think that advice must be, you know, very, very specifically tailored to the individual. And that's true. But, you know, as behavioral scientists, we know that there are certain tracks, and we know that there are certain truisms that are true for the vast majority of the population. So, you know, while the individuals are different, while the situations are different, there are some general rules that we can follow and that we can recommend with a really high degree of certainty. So, you know, for example, one thing that we see in research that is kind of counterintuitive to traditional wisdom is the importance of an emergency savings fund, even if that means waiting to pay down high interest debt. So, you know, we're very aware that we have this track that we can sort of funnel people through. You see a lot of people coming to financial advising, financial coaching, who want to invest but have high interest debt, or want to invest but they don't have an emergency savings fund started. So what you can really do is we can, you know, create this checklist, and we can say, do you have, you know, an emergency savings fund? Do you have an emergency savings fund started? And we can check, you know, how much money is in that emergency savings fund, because there's also just enormous variability in what people think constitutes emergency savings. Some people think it's $400. Some people think it's 6 months of income. Actually, the statistically sound, the new number that economists has come up with is at $2,467. Have either of you heard this?
No, but like, is that a nice round $2,400? Is that like, and 24 cents
more? Yeah, okay. It's around, let me say 2,400. It's researched by Emily Gallagher, but it's for LMI folks, that's the number, $2,467, where another dollar added doesn't protect tremendously against additional stress. So if you have around 2,400 saved, you're much, much less likely to be evicted
you're much less likely to have a debt go into collections. You're much less likely to have a catastrophic financial event that sends you into that deep spiral of debt. So, you know, up until that 2400 threshold, you see a significant gain for each dollar added to your emergency savings fund. After that, the next dollar added doesn't really help as much. So that's not a number that people are particularly familiar with, but that's a number that we care about a lot. And, you know, having that resilience, that emergency savings fund can be more important than paying off your high interest debt, because the money that goes into your debt, you cannot recover if you have a health emergency, if you have, you know, if you're out of work for a couple of weeks and you lose that income. So having that emergency savings fund prevents you from getting into a more intense crisis. So we can sort of triage and we can say, if you don't have this amount, start here, then go to your high interest debt. Then you start to think about, you know, what are your acquisition of assets? What are you trying to accomplish with your money? But filtering people through those paths that we're pretty aware of can be really, really useful when we think about how do we design paths that make financial advice scalable.
Yeah, that's a super valid point. And it's designing paths, right? I don't know. Again, I'm not the expert here, but I feel like just even in my own personal circles, right? Like if I talk to people, depending on what their starting point is, they don't know what the path they need to take is. And sometimes that path changes too, right? Like if you're today, if you're paycheck to paycheck plus a lot of high interest debt, you know, your recommendation may be to them, hey, we need to build up an emergency savings account so that you don't have to, you know, all of a sudden you have a sick kid and a medical bill that needs to be paid. And all of a sudden you're taking out a payday loan that's, you know, ridiculously gouging interest. And then it just snowballs and becomes very, very difficult to get out. Whereas you could have leveraged your, you know, savings, emergency savings for that. But exactly. If you've already got an emergency savings fund and now you just need a plan for paying down high interest debt, or maybe just now you have no high interest debt and you have a savings fund, now how do you start to actually accumulate some wealth? You know, you made a comment earlier. It's like it's a stress reliever, right? I mean, how often do we talk about in this industry? It comes up all the time on the podcast. You know, the old adage, like money doesn't buy happiness, but I tell you what, don't have any money. And like, it's hard. It's stressful, mm-hmm. right? It's really hard to just be happy when, this thing that the world revolves around is kind of looming over your head. So, you know, how do you, it's really interesting to hear you talk about the different behavioral elements of trying to guide people to the right path based on what the right path actually might be for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think one thing that's nice about, you know, the program that we worked on with Matt is that he has tracks, right? Right. Sort of, you know, a library of to-dos that you can pull out and assign to folks. And what we find is that there are a couple to-dos that are applied to most people. So, you know, contrary to thinking that each person needs a highly individualized plan, we do see these sort of patterns emerge, and we're able to sort people, triage people into a couple different groups, and really start to get them along whatever, you know, one of those couple paths makes most sense for their situation.
And just jumping in on that, what was also really interesting in working with the financial planners that were participating in this research project is that they got really efficient on being able to deliver that advice, right? And you could also imagine down the road the possibility of automating certain aspects. So someone's just reviewing and then approving, right? So like review and approve. But they got really streamlined in like creating interaction flows where maybe there's an assistant, the way that we did it, there was an assistant that was connected that sat between the person receiving the advice and the person giving advice, so that if the person who received advice had a question or just, you know, wanted some reassurance or just wanted to connect with someone, that you can provide someone for them to connect to text with or email with or whatever. And then it's still the person who has the financial expertise can still provide that advice in a way that's really, they're spending their time in a way that's very efficient and high impact. And we found that, you know, 90% of the messages that were sent in that were inbound messages from the people receiving advice, that an assistant would handily deal with those, right? So then you create this sort of this workflow within the experience where people are feeling still very connected to someone who's looking out for them, and that they can get personalized, individuated support around their financial situation. But like the advisors are really focusing on like, okay, how do we, what are the things that you need to do? Like Sid was talking about, like what are the, and those tend to track pretty consistently across somebody's profile and the information they share, their financial goals, the types of financial accounts they have, how much they have in savings, what types of debt they have, like those types of things that you can gather through an intake form, essentially, or a web app. And that then that generates into an interface that would make it easy for someone to say like, okay, here's what you need to work on. Here are the deadlines for those things. Like, let me know if you need to adjust these, or, you know, we need to make some changes to your plan.
Matt, I've thrown out a dangerous topic here, and I hate to use the just buzzword of the day, but how do you think things like just some of the crazy advancements that we're seeing in AI and things like chat GPT, like how do you think that's going to impact what you were just talking about?
Yeah, I was also just thinking about that before. And I've been talking with friends about it as well, and I'd love to get Sid's take on this, particularly from a behavioral perspective. But I think, you know, we're going to maybe fairly quickly be able to get to a point where we can deliver really good advice, right? And I think the thing that's a little different in my mind is the empathy, right? And maybe chatbots will be able to get really good at empathy as well, right? And like making connection with people and getting to know them and being able to provide advice. I think there may be something to, if a person is investing their time in helping me, like I feel like a deeper connection to that because we are human beings and we are relational, that I respect that a little bit more as opposed to like a chatbot with text reminders. But there's also, I think, I was talking to someone yesterday and they highlighted there's a bot called the Woebot. Are you familiar with that? Uh-uh. W-O-E. It's around like mental health. It's AI and mental health counseling and you know, having an AI to be able to connect with around that. And that I think over time, people get more comfortable with that, with the idea of being able to interact with something that's an automated platform, but also understands you at a reasonable level, right? And so I think this is coming, for sure is coming, right? It's here partly, and it's going to get a lot better. And so I think that there's an interesting component to that. And I was also just looking at some of your episode summaries and saw that you had Ron Shevlin on recently. And I really loved how there was like a rain cloud behind his Bitmoji, which is so appropriate. Because I met Ron probably 2009 at Binnovate conference first time or something. But I think, you know, there's this whole idea of being able to, you know, that fewer people are going into branches, right? Like if you're talking about like financial institutions. And so like they're going to be interacting more with technology, and that's going to be their preference, right? And so how do we think about serving them, meeting them where they're at, right? As opposed to like treating them based on geography, meeting them where they're at, what are their needs? How do we help them based on what their needs are and their goals? And maybe they need to adjust their goals a little bit because they're thinking about it. Like they're focusing on investing, but they don't have an emergency savings account. Right? And so like maybe we need to help them recalibrate a little bit and then help them actually execute. But I think that there's a really interesting use case for how technology is going to be applied to a data set so that we can look at all the recommendations, like in the research that we did. We didn't do this, but you could imagine it's certainly possible. Look at all the recommendations and advice, apply machine learning to that, and really start to scale it like dramatically. And so I think while still feeling like they're the person in the process.
Yeah, that's, yeah. You know, oh, Sid, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking, I think we're going to have a lot of fun as researchers thinking about how AI chatbots interact in terms of you know, these competing theories around financial coaching and financial advising, this idea that it's hard to be vulnerable. It's hard to disclose your financial troubles. So, you know, sort of score one for an AI system that isn't going to judge you, isn't going to, you know, have any emotions about your financial situation versus this understanding of, you know, trust, right? So we think that it's important to trust a financial advisor. So I think there's going to be some pretty interesting research looking at, you know, does having a smart assistant that doesn't have a consciousness help increase comfort with having these types of conversations, or does it hurt it? You know, and even, you know, just from an efficiency standpoint, I've heard folks around the lab talk about the 80-20 rule, sort of like imagining letting an AI do 80% of the work, and then you sort of take over the 20% of the work of reviewing and revising and editing what that has produced.
I'm glad that too you brought this up, and Matt, I'm glad you used a very specific word in there, empathy. It's really interesting. You know, I was thinking about that when I had Ron on, because he was talking about the death of branches. And, you know, one of the things that I love about Ron is that, you know, he's even the self-prescribed like doom and gloom, and he'll look at it from, you know, possibly the worst case scenario. And, you know, I appreciated that he actually balanced a little bit of our conversation out about that. But, you know, he was talking about like, do we eventually get to the complete death of branches where, you know, all of my interactions are AI based? And I think one of my interesting, you know, arguments and pushbacks to that is that at the end of the day, you know, look at how the pandemic, it both taught us that we could do things virtually, but it also taught us like the importance of the human connection. It also taught me that sometimes I just really want to hug, like, and I can't do that over Zoom. And so in my eyes, I thought that a lot of the missing element of technology was empathy. And so I was actually just listening to a podcast, someone else's podcast, with Lex Fridman talking about ChatGPT. And he was talking about how the most recent release of it is starting to understand empathy. And he used the example of, you know, if you ask just a quote unquote dumb chatbot or something, you know, when was World War II? It'll tell you the dates, started here, ended here, right? But they're starting to learn that, like, when you're asking that, there's a lot of gravity behind that. Like, that was a world war that a lot of people lost their lives. There was, you know, human atrocities that are attached to that. It's not just as black and white as, well, the war started on this date and it ended on this date. Like, there's a lot more to that. And that got me thinking about, you know, yeah, if I go to a chatbot on my community financial institution's website and I'm typing in, you know, my dog just got sick and I just got a vet bill for $1,000 and I can't cover it and I'm freaking out and I don't know what to do about my dog. Like, if the chatbot returns a very cold response, that's a missed opportunity, right? Where if the chatbot responds, it's like, oh my gosh, Josh, I'm so sorry. Like, I hope your dog is okay. We've got tools to help. Like, we're going to make sure, like, Frankie keeps snoring in the back of your podcasts for years to come, right? Like, that's going to be a very different experience. So I think that's where it's going to get really fascinating is when we start to be able to have, you know, computers with empathy. Like, I don't know if I really at least love master. Or am terrified of that at the same time.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Sid.
About how, you know, the difference between a bank and a credit union and how well they're, you know, how rigidly that system is set up and how much agency an individual person has to make decisions based on empathy. And I'm, you know, I'm getting off track here, but I'm thinking that AI chatbot might work a lot better for a bank than for a credit union, in my experience, because, you know, the larger the organization is, the less agency any individual has to bend the rules or to, you know, make decisions based on the emotional valence of the situation. Whereas that's something that I observe happening extremely consistently when you look at, you know, a community credit union with a smaller membership. So I think that's an interesting element too, is how it will affect different institutions differently.
Yeah. You know, the opening question I asked the two of you was just, you know, why does any of this matter? Like, why is it even important that we have this conversation about, you know, understanding the behavioral science behind what makes people tick and think around how they manage their finances? And what's really interesting to me as somebody who works in the community financial services industry, and somebody who's really bought into this model and somebody who is even, you know, personally saved by this model as well, is there's still a ton of people that fall through the cracks. Like there's still a colossal amount of unbanked and underbanked people in the US. And there's even a ton of people that are banked, that are members of a credit union that are really struggling with their finances, right? And so even though there is the right idea behind, you know, even the credit union motto of people helping people, like the right idea is there, but it's just going back to this whole conversation we've had, like actually delivering that at scale, right? Like I always talk about, you know, at my credit union, it was Mayree who saved me, right? And so I always say, like, I wish everybody had a Mayree. And as much as I love her, I can't just like clone her and give her to everybody so that everybody can have the experience that I had. But technology can kind of help with that. So, you know, as you two have done some of this research, what are some of the other things that like surprised you as you started to uncover why there is the need to have this conversation and why there's the need to actually try and help recreate better financial habits, even for as advanced of a country as the US is?
Well, I can, as far as why this is important, I think I volunteer at this, at a nonprofit that runs a pro bono financial planning platform. And so I interact from time to time with the people who are actually getting the support. I'm not a financial planner, but I sort of serve this support or assistant role. And just the idea that people can connect with somebody who can help them think through what it is they should be doing, like whether they just, they're thinking growing their family or buying a house or whatever it is, like somebody to have a connection and be able to get some good trusted advice, I think is really both foundational and transformational, I think, for people. It's like we should all be getting that. But also when people do get that kind of advice, that it makes a big difference for how they think about it. And if they can persist with that person over time and reconnect with them when something changes in their life, but you know, that, or they get some coaching, right? Like I'm going to come up with, and this is how we did it in the RCT, the study. We had people check in like 3 to 4 weeks later, to see how people were doing. And so I think that having somebody that you can connect with and that you trust and you build a relationship with is really important. And I think when you think of financial institutions, it's like creating that digital on-ramp, right? Like making it easy for people to say like, hey, here are my goals. Here's my situation. Here's what I'd really like to talk about or get help with. And then facilitating that connection because, you know, financial institutions have lots of people that could be helpful in those situations. But how do you connect the people who want that help with the people who are there to help? And if more and more people aren't going into the branches, then I mean, not that the branches are dead. Maybe that's a little bit too dramatic, but I think if people want and expect to get help, and we're all so used to messaging now, right? Like, how do I open up that channel to be able to have that connection? I think what we've seen at the nonprofit is just people are super grateful to be able to have someone to connect with that they can trust, who's going to be able to accompany them on at least some part of their financial journey. And I think that is a big stress reliever. It induces confidence. People are more confident. They're more likely to take action. They have a goal that they're focused on. There's all these things and behavioral strategies that you can nest into that experience that are going to help people make more progress and do better.
Yeah. And I think in addition to that, you know, as we were talking about earlier, we really see patterns in terms of who's in the know and who isn't. So one of the partnerships that the center has right now is with a financial advice firm that focuses specifically or provides services specifically to Black Americans and Americans who are financially very well off, doing very financially well for themselves. But, you know, what we see when we, you know, conduct, you know, when we sort of interview folks involved is that, you know, certain marginalized groups do not necessarily have that lineage of knowledge that more privileged groups have. And what I mean by that is that, you know, again, are your parents telling you how to invest? Are your parents, you know, setting you up with some sort of savings account or trust fund? Or do you have to figure this out on your own when you have money or even if you don't have money, right?
So I think that that's what really motivates me to democratize financial advice, is that idea that in so many cases, it's passed on through families. And if you do not happen to, you know, grow up in an environment where that advice is shared, especially because of the incredible amount of stigma that we have in this country about discussing finances, you will remain in the dark. And there's very, very few opportunities to meaningfully get that information.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, even again, just in my own experience, right? I mean, that's so incredibly apparent that you see a lot of this quote unquote financial knowledge is both knowledge that is passed down from generation to generation of just, hey, Sid, from the time you were a small child, we taught you how to be smart about money. We taught you how to use, you know, debt instruments. We taught you how to leverage investing, and we taught you how to do all these things. And, you know, if you start from that from a very young age and you start from a better position, it's like night and day difference. But it's also even just, you know, what's set up for you in terms of success. Like, look, I know that there's a total quote unquote, like, cheat the system, and I'm trying to set it up for my kid. Like, he's already got a savings account. He already has an investment account. He's already got a college savings fund, right? Why? Because I understand how the world works. Like, the world works. If you're set up better for success, you have a better shot. And so I want to set him up for success, right? But like, so many times people don't get that.
Exactly.
And so yeah, their starting points are so much worse. And you just see such a big disparity in even the US and people's starting points.
Yeah. And even when you're, you know, passing along financial advice to your children, like, you know, many, many, many families are going to do this, but the type of financial advice that you're getting is going to vary by background. So, you know, I grew up in an LMI house, and the advice that I got was never go into debt, never go into any type of debt. What that means is that I became, you know, an adult and didn't have a credit history because I wasn't, you know, appropriately using those debt instruments to build credit. And I think that that's something that I see with a lot of vulnerable populations, is the lessons taught are about resilience, and they're about protecting the assets that you have versus acquiring new assets versus, you know, growing your wealth. So I think that's a complicated position that people get into as well.
Yeah. You know, that's a really good point, Sid. I mean, it's super complicated, right? And what was the word you used when we were talking earlier? You said it, like, the financial system is very opaque, right?
Yep.
And it's sometimes like we just don't have a full picture of the whole thing, and it's so complicated. And so, yeah, like, just going through all the different stages without like a guiding path to say, okay, like, you reached checkmark A, so we're going to change strategies. We're going to go to, you know, your next step is B, and then now we're going to go to C. And it doesn't just stop with, okay, you've got, you know, your $2,400. Like, you just don't have to worry about anymore. It's like, great. Well, we got you there. Like, let's take the next step. And
exactly
that, like, that journey for most of us is like, we don't have visibility into it.
Yeah. There's so much competing advice. There's so much fear around offering specific advice, because if you offer advice and it doesn't go well, you might be liable. So even if you want to learn about, you know, the financial world and you type in financial education, you're not necessarily going to get something that's useful. You're not going to get actionable advice. You're going to get some quizzes about a lot of terms that are about as useful to you as algebra, about as useful to you as, you know, a high school math class. And I think that level of, you know, what is the actionable advice that is useful to you for your situation is something that the industry hasn't fully been able to deliver as of yet.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this. One of, I grew up in a like hot rod car family. So I've always been into cars as a kid. So that's my, you know, not so dirty secret hobby. I'm a big fan of cars. And so I'm on a, you know, handful of different, social media groups and forums and different things. And Matt, that's one of the areas that I found it's been really fascinating to watch, even just because I'm kind of in, like, that's something that I look at online, right? One of the things I get a lot of advertisements for is people trying to sell me their advice on how to, like, buy a supercar, right? And then you see in all these comments, and it is just fascinating to me that people are like willing to die on the hill that like, you know, and we're just using a very simple example of like, some people are like, oh my gosh, you should never ever, you know, finance a purchase like this. If you can't pay cash for it, you can't afford it. To people that are like, well, interest rates are 1.99 on new autos right now. You should finance 100% of that and invest your money and everything in between. And whatever their position is, like I said, like they're willing to die on that hill over it. And you're like, oh my gosh, like there's so much advice out there. Again, it, like you were saying, Sid, I mean, it's just sometimes wading through all that advice and trying to figure out what you should trust when you have a trusted option, like the two of you have been talking about, like a trusted option that actually takes inputs and variables and then makes prescriptive advice and then actually helps you to understand how to like approach it behaviorally so that you actually get the outcomes. That's so different than just your buddy down the street told you, you know, you should buy that car with cash because if you can't, you can't afford it.
Oh yeah, it's so rare. And much more likely than your buddy down the street in this day and age is you'll get a financial influencer on something like Instagram. And the way that you get famous on Instagram for providing financial advice is not necessarily for providing the best advice. It's for providing the flashiest advice.
Yeah.
Or the advice that promises to get you the biggest gain in the next week. And the advice that is the most controversial.
Dogecoin to the moon. That, yeah.
Yeah. And when that combines with the culture of Instagram, the culture of, you know, trying to appeal to people in the same demographic as you or from the same background as you, it can get pretty unhealthy and pretty nasty and pretty unhelpful to people who are, you know, turning to that group for financial advice. And sometimes it works really, really well, but there's just no quality control whatsoever. And we see a lot of people turning to social media and influencers for advice, which is very complicated, but indicates that there's really no quality controlled, you know, democratized advice that's available to
the general. It shows that there's a lot of different advices, right? But it also shows that there's a lot of people that are yearning for that, right? Like when you find somebody's got millions of views on their video of how to get out of debt or how to create, you know, emergency savings fund, and there's millions and millions of views of it, like that right there should tell us there's a yearning for that information.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. More often it's how to invest in crypto, you know, because the emergency savings fund, not necessarily the sexiest, the most fun advice that you can get, but you know,
I think that's super interesting too. In that, like in that same medium, like literally you could be scrolling through and you get an ad for somebody trying to sell you their advice on how to, you know, make millions. And then right below that, there's an advertiser trying to sell you some crap you don't need, right? Like talk about a rough world to grow up in and not have any good, solid financial foundation of advice to like build off of. Mm-hmm. And being thrown into that, you know, Instagram world of take this crazy advice so I can get richer. And oh, by the way, at the same time, buy this product. And then right behind it is, you know, Capital One's like, hey, Matt, you want another credit card?
And yeah. I think also it's a testament to the power of platforms, right? And just the ability for them to aggregate large numbers of people. And then they can decide how they, like what type of advice is good for you or not good for you. But there's not a lot of algorithms aren't thinking about that, right? About your financial situation or looking at the determinants, what your risk tolerance is, right? Like what your loss aversion, you know, how strongly you react to loss. And so I think there's just an interesting way to think about the platforms, like the, and these coming technologies. ChatGPT is a good example, and there'll be a few fast followers here in the next couple of weeks, I think, you know, as far as other solutions and see how those respond. But yeah, getting good advice, like there's a ton of opportunities to do that. And if you're already a trusted institution, you already have a relationship, like extend that and be able to do more with people. It seems like a natural way of thinking about it, but also like, I do remember at one point I was at a conference, and we were talking about like digital ways to engage people in the branch. And I remember someone saying like, hey, that's really interesting. That app's really interesting, but can you do that in paper? And I was like, whoa, I'm in the wrong place here. You know, like, can we just get that as a, like a one pager that we can hand people and then like somebody can input that data? And it's like, oh, wow, that's really interesting thinking. You know,
that's very kind of you. That's an interesting way of thinking about it. I was going to say, I just saw it in the news this morning that Google announced that they're going to be releasing their ChatGPT competitor within the Google search bar in the coming weeks, it sounds like. So this could get really interesting really fast, where basically what they were saying is you can type in much more complex questions into Google. And again, it'll actually understand intent and provide empathetic human-esque responses. It's going to be fascinating to see how many people, what people are searching, but it's going to be fascinating to see how much people start to ask Google complex financial decisions. Like, hey, Google, I'm thinking about buying this new car. You know, my buddy down the street says that if I can't buy it in all cash, then like I shouldn't buy it. But I've also heard that, you know, I should be able to finance a part of it. Like, what do you think, Google? Like, and they can type that whole darn thing.
Right.
And what's Google going to respond with? Like, Google Pay. Fascinating to me.
They'll just extend Google Pay, right?
Yeah.
It's like,
we actually encourage you to buy that car on Google Pay. Tap the pay. Away you go. Yeah.
Man, as a researcher and as, you know, coming from a lab that, you know, is just constantly sounding the ringing the gong of RCTs and testing before action, it's really, really complicated and interesting to think about Google rolling out a product that has so many implications, real world implications to how people exist. And I wonder, you know, without necessarily an ability to track unintended consequences versus intended consequences. I mean, I don't know how much visibility Google has into my bank account at this point. They might be able to tell me every single penny I have. But yeah, really, really interesting to think about how that might be, how success might be measured.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, Sid, because, you know, at the end of the day, who owns the recommendation that's made and the outcomes of that, right? So I was reading a news story recently about, I'm getting a little morbid here, but this guy's wife goes missing, right? And the police kind of suspect the husband. And so they start doing all this digging and they start going through his Google search history. And it's creepy. The whole night before she goes missing, he's up all night on Google and he's not shy one bit. He's Googling like, should I hack a body up before moving it or after moving it? Like, that's terrifying, right? But that's what he's inputting into here. So like the comment was when you start to get to the, so if I put that into ChatGPT, like should ChatGPT give me a really solid answer on how to dispose a human body? Or should it take an ethical approach and be like, hey, Josh, actually, we see that you're starting to ask some questions. Like, are you doing okay? Like, can we put you in touch with a mental health counselor or something? Like, I don't know, man. Like, we're getting really far out of my comfort zone here. But
yeah.
Like, that's some really complex topics. So just bringing it back to the simple stuff, like what happens if Google does say, I type in there, like, should I buy this car this way or that way? And Google gives me advice and it's really bad advice. Like, who owns the responsibility for that? I think that's going to be pretty interesting.
Yeah, is ChatGPT going to be convicted of a billion crimes 2 weeks after it comes out as an accomplice?
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. I think I'd just be curious to know it's like what, you know, what Google is imagining in terms of, you know, if we were rolling out, you know, AI assisted tech financial advisor, we would be looking at, you know, outcome metrics. Like, does this provide advice that actually helps people become financially healthy? And that's sort of what we did, you know, when Matt and I and us collaborated on this project, is we did look at, you know, how does this actually affect, you know, how people take that financial advice? And, you know, does this actually, you know, ideally we want to look at, does this, you know, contribute to positive financial outcomes? Because one thing that we see over and over again in behavioral science is sometimes you can think that one thing is going to happen and the opposite happens. And sometimes you can have unintended effects, especially when you get to, you know, groups that are outside of the sort of privileged stream that a lot of things are designed to accommodate. So there can be, you know, intense ramifications and negative ramifications for different cultural groups, for, you know, different
races, for, you know, minority genders, all of this stuff. And I think that's something that I would be really, you know, concerned about as far as, you know, rolling out a massive financial advice generator.
Yeah. Matt, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think Sid's right on. And I think that there's, you know, ultimately, I think Google owns it, you know, or whoever designs the advice, you know, it's their algorithms, it's their learning. And that's how I would think about it, right? Like it's, they're providing, and I think right now you ask, you know, you could ask questions like, what are 10 things that I could do to improve my financial situation, right? Like, what are 10 actions? And you might get some pretty, and because it's sort of indexing what's out there, you'll get some non-controversial options, right? Like, well, you can spend less on eating out. You could sell something that you own, you know, like, how do I get more money back from my pocket? But as we go down this road of giving people more personalized advice, and even when you give that advice, like, does that system have full view into everything that's going on? Like, it's really hard to get a full view into everything. And even, oh, and by the way, we're pregnant, right? Oh, you're pregnant. Like, that totally changes the advice that I'm going to give you, right? And so this is something to, you know, that you're going to sort of like, there's going to be a lot of caveats. And I think that's why having a human in the loop in some way is still a really important function, because there's that ability to sort of connect and divulge information, perhaps. I mean, maybe AI systems can get really good at follow-up questions and being able to sort of like suss out what may be important. But I think, like we're having, right? We're having a bit of a free-ranging conversation. And once you start to do that and you sort of open up the channels, the dialogue channels, things naturally pop into that you wouldn't have initially thought to share, right? And then I think having that back and forth and having those connections, and maybe there's a difference when it's a real person on the other end, and maybe there's not a difference when there's a real person on the other end. And that's the question I don't have an answer to. But I think that there's, yeah, that it's going to be really interesting to see. You know, I remember hearing, I don't know if it was Yuval Harari or somebody, some big thinker saying, like, you know, what should people be studying right now, right? Like in college, what's going to be a good job market? And I think his answer was something along the lines of like philosophy, because all these things that we were just philosophical questions, now we're actually starting to have to deal with them, right? Like, do we train an AI to like run into an object so that the child in the crosswalk is protected, or do we protect the driver and hit whoever's in the crosswalk, right? Like these sorts of things are now starting to become real questions with real world implications.
Yeah. Well, and we've talked about this in the past too. You know, you think about it even on a very basic level, right? You get a community financial institution that deploys an AI chatbot, and it, you know, somebody comes and asks it a question like, you know, I don't know, how do I transfer money from checking to savings? And it's like, wow, you dummy, you don't know how to do that? You're like, who owns that? Like, that's a huge brain reputational risk, right? For that comment that bot just made. But like, who owns that? Is it the person who wrote the algorithm for how this thing should respond? Is it the company? Is it the financial institution? Like, that starts to get a little gray area.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just bringing my own brain to this, my own biases here. But I think that, you know, there's generally a pattern in tech of creating something without fully necessarily thinking out all of the potential ramifications. And again, this is also probably, you know, me as a researcher wanting to fully understand something before I recommend it. And you know, thinking that it's really important to, you know, yes, design solutions that scale, that democratize, that make a difference, but also to make sure that you fully understand those solutions and that you have a very firm grasp on what they mean and how they work before you roll that out. So it's sort of not even a massive experiment, because there's not necessarily a control group and nothing's really being measured. So I think that's one of my bottom lines is, experimenting.
And like you were talking about earlier, Sid, that I think one of the elements of this is that, you know, especially in financial services, like our lives are super fragmented right now, right? I had Danny Payne from Jack Henry on recently, and he and I were talking about, open your phone and tell me how many financial services apps you have on your phone. And I absolutely guarantee you it's more than you think.
Yeah.
In orders of magnitude, right? So, you know, Sid, you made the comment earlier, like, well, does Google have access to my bank account to know? It's even more than that. It's like, does Google have access to my bank account? Well, all 12 of them. Does it have access to all of my loan products? Does it have access to all of my investment portfolios? Does it have access to XYZ? Like, being able to have a full comprehensive picture is also very difficult today.
Yep. Yeah. And I know that some fintech, some companies are trying to be the consolidator, are trying to, you know, and I think that might be where the industry is headed towards, is greater efforts to consolidate, especially as things get more and more fragmented. But I mean, you know, also thinking about scaling, I think it's important to make a distinction, you know, between scaling and universalizing, right? So understanding that some things are not going to be generalizable, understanding and accepting and appreciating that you are not going to be able to create a product that works for everyone. And that when you do, you know, if you do think that you're creating a product that works for everyone, you're more likely to have something that actually harms certain people who aren't adequately represented within that product. So I think, you know, when you're thinking about scaling, you know, think about your audience, make sure that you understand them, make sure that you're building for them specifically, make sure that you have, you know, a holistic understanding of the type of person that you're trying to help. You know, is your audience young? Does your audience have debt? You know, what variables can we tightly control, and how can we, you know, apply these variables to certain paths? So I think that's, you know, when we think about, you know, financial advice that works for everyone, I'm sure at some point we'll get to that place, and we won't get to that place unless we, you know, mess around with AI and ChatGPT and you know, all of these different systems. But I think there's still a case for this sort of middle ground where you're scaling without universalizing, without trying to be the solution for everyone.
Go ahead, Matt.
No, I totally agree with Sid. You know, I think that's really an important component of just being able to think through all the possibilities and protect people at the same time. That's an important piece of good financial advice, right? It's not, we think of it as optimizing for everything, right? And there's a certain profile where that are definitely optimizers, right? But then you have people that don't think about things that way. So if you have a system that's designed for optimization and you're not an optimizer, like, it's not going to be a good fit. And so I think and again, I think that's where bringing somebody into the process who can help with understanding who is this person, like, what do they know, your customer, right? Like, what do they need? That would be a lot more successful.
Yeah. I mean, this is why I've been so excited to talk to the two of you. I mean, the human brain is just fascinating, right? And like you were saying, Sid, I mean, there are so many things. Yes, we're all unique, we're all individual, but there's also so many things that we all do the exact same way. But we all will, like, take the same option or follow the same path. And, you know, some of that is just instinctual, and some of that is learned behavior, and some of that is cultural behavior, and some of that is, you know, all sorts of different variables that go into this. And, you know, like the two of you have been saying, it's next to impossible to create something that fits for absolutely everybody. But it's also a balance of, you know, like you were saying, Sid, trying to get processes to fit people, not people to fit processes. And come up with ways where we're actually going to be able to provide value that has a higher retention rate of getting people to a successful endpoint.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that, you know, people do a lot of funky stuff. People have a lot of flaws in their thinking. But I think that it's important to realize that there are reasons why we evolved to have those flaws, like those so-called flaws. There are
for everything that you might consider a cognitive bias, there's a situation in which it is helpful. There's a situation in which it makes sense. And I think that dismissing what we call cognitive biases as weaknesses, as things to just overcome through sheer force of will, is, you know, really not being respectful to how good our brains are at keeping us alive and keeping us safe. And we should be designing to accommodate and respect those flaws and those, you know, those biases, those things that we consider our weaknesses, instead of trying to ignore or overcome them.
Yeah. You know, I probably overuse this, but I'm a huge fan of it, right? You can't judge a fish by his ability to climb a tree, right?
Exactly.
The fish will think he sucks. If you judge him by how good he is at swimming, like, that's a little bit more reasonable. And I think a lot of times, like you've been saying, you know, we try and, well, you need to fit into this financial model. Well, maybe there are elements of that that work and that are common across larger subsets of people, but there are also some nuanced ways that we need to approach that. And being able to understand people's behavioral tendencies, their habits, and the way that they actually change and adapt and respond, and applying those to how do we create paths for people to ultimately get to a better financial place. And then how do we at scale replicate that for millions of people? It's no small feat. I don't know. But it's really cool that people are actually, again, that people care and that they're talking about it.
Yeah, it's tough, but it's interesting and it's really fun to think this way about problems.
You know, one of the things that I really wanted to talk to the two of you about too. So I had a guest on in the early days of the podcast, Marla Vandenacker, who was also on to talk about kind of just the behavioral, the way the brain ticks around money. And one of the conversations that we had was something that you touched on earlier, Sid. And I'd love to get just your thoughts and expansion on. We have gone so far into this realm of frictionless in lots of different areas of our lives. And one of those areas, financial institutions are trying to push for, you know, the most efficient ways to do money movement and payments. And then businesses are trying to do everything in their power to make it as efficient and effortless to buy something as possible. I mean, how easy is it now to be on Instagram, to see something, say, I want that, click it, and it literally just say, you know, double click the lock button on your iPhone, pay for this thing with Apple Pay, we'll pull all of your information, we'll process the payment, and that thing's shipped. And you're one click on a screen and two clicks on the side of your phone, and you just bought something. It could be a very expensive item, right? Like, what are your thoughts on just what are the ramifications? Like, what are we potentially setting ourselves up for, positive or negative, in making it so easy and going back to just that like societal reward system for spending money? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was just talking to some colleagues about how we as a human race are really, really tapping into that deep evolutionary stuff right now, right? We're really getting to that place where we're appealing to something pretty subconscious, and we're really good at doing that. And I think that one of the challenging and nice things about being a behavioral researcher, being in behavioral economics, is every big company also has a behavioral economics sort of, you know, unit and is, you know, using these sort of tendencies that we have, these blind spots, these complexities, these sometimes adaptive, sometimes maladaptive tendencies against us, or to lure us down the wrong path, or the path that doesn't align with our values and our goals. And I think that, you know, one thing that the center tries to do is figure out how to reintroduce friction in healthy ways, encourage companies to use good friction to help people slow down and actually make that decision about, you know, what aligns with their values, what aligns with their goals, and to then remove friction for saving behaviors, remove friction for, you know, doing something like paying off your total balance on your credit card instead of your minimum balance, because a lot of, you know, credit cards
really push that minimum balance. And it really is a matter of, you know, smart and ethical decisions about where you're adding the friction and where you're removing it. And, it is a constant battle to, you know, try to ensure that as many people as possible are including the right processes and including friction in the right places in their processes.
You know, it's funny, Matt, you'll appreciate this. So when I had Marla on, one of the things we were talking about is they were just starting to talk about the concept of the Amazon store where you just walk in, grab an item and walk out and you get charged for it later type of thing. And Matt, I actually had an opportunity to have my first experience with that in the Bay Area not too long ago. And I was there for some meetings and saw one of these Amazon stores. I was like, oh, man, obviously have to check this out for research. And yeah, you literally just, you know, scan a barcode on your Amazon app to get into the store. You get in. It was trippy. I felt like a thief the whole time I was there because I was just like grabbing things. And I was like, okay, I guess I just leave. And I just left. And I literally made myself a reminder on my calendar to go back and check my Amazon account to actually validate my purchases and make sure they were correct. It was all correct. But it really got me thinking, like, I'm curious if I lived super close to that and that was where I did a lot of my shopping, like, how much more would I spend on my groceries? Like, I'm just so disassociated from the spend at that point. Like, I literally walked out of the Amazon store. I was like, I have no idea how much I paid for this. I could have paid $94 for that apple. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I just grabbed stuff and left.
Yeah. Dan Ariely, who runs the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke, I remember him talking about the pain of paying, right? And that if there's no pain in paying, then it's just like, you know, it's kind of a free for all. And if you switch yourself back to all cash, right? Like, I've got to actually take out money from my wallet and give this to somebody or give it somewhere. There's a little more pain involved than like tapping your phone on a terminal to be able to register that and get a receipt versus just like grabbing and walking, right? Then there's zero friction. I mean, other than you have to walk into a building and the energy to go and the cognitive energy to figure out what you actually want. It's fascinating, right? But that's absolutely the direction that we're moving, because that just means more revenue for the companies that, and their stock price goes up, right? Like, the shareholders are happy. That is the environment that we operate in, right? And that those companies operate in. So it's like the innovation is all about how do you increase revenue. And I think for banks and credit unions, it's also the same way, but it's also doing it in a way that these are customers. We want to protect them at the same time and help them with the things that are important to them. And by doing that, we also help ourselves, right? So that's this mutually beneficial experience.
It's super interesting, like, how we have just evolved as humans too, right? Because you think about, you know, there was a point in time where if you grew tomatoes and I built fences and I wanted tomatoes and you wanted a fence to keep wildlife out from eating your tomatoes, like, I built your fence and you gave me tomatoes. And like, that was how, and so it was very, you know, very real to think about, okay, well, how much effort does it take me to grow these tomatoes? How much is it worth it for me to have a fence? So I'll give you, you know, 20 pounds of tomatoes. And then I'm like, well, but this is really hard work to build the fence. Like, I think I deserve 25 pounds of tomatoes. I don't know, you know, but going from that very, very real, like, connection to this is the amount of effort I had to do to get this thing to now, I'm like, well, I mean, I tell my wife, I just, you know, run my mouth for a living and somehow somebody pays me for it because I'm in sales and I gotta really do anything tangible, right? It's not like I'm building a fence for anybody or anything, but then I'm given money and then I use that money and I just walk into an Amazon store and I grab tomatoes and I like walk out. It's like, we're so far disassociated from that. Like, well, I had to do work and to do something to earn this coin to then go purchase these. Like, it's interesting how we've evolved so much from like a trade and barter to where we are today.
From there to FTX. And then we've got like billions of crypto dollars like out there in the ether, right? So yeah, I mean, it's so wild. Sid, sorry, I cut you off. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're thinking along this same lines. Like, you're abstracting something that was already a symbol of labor, right? You're turning money, already just paper, into something not even tangible, not even physical. And I think the ramifications of that are going to be really interesting. And I think we're only beginning to see how much our thinking about money changes and how much our sort of understanding of that transaction changes when all of, you know, when our transactions are shifting more and more and more to the completely digital, and even to the point where you're not even pulling out your credit card to pay, right? So, you know, we're going from bartering to handing over dollars to swiping your credit card to tapping your credit card to using Apple Pay to, you know, not even getting your card out of your wallet. And I think that progression is really, really affecting how people think about purchasing behavior.
What's interesting too is that, like, we've talked about the stress of being in a poor financial position, right? But there's also, like, the rush of buying something, right? And getting that, you know, short-term gratification. And, you know, I really want this new TV. And so I go into Costco and I buy this new TV and I'm like super happy. And then I have a later realization of like, oh crap, like that put me into debt that I shouldn't have put myself into. It's interesting to see how, like, that whole evolution of things has created that, like, back and forth of stress, reward. And it does just go to show just how much our lives are controlled by money. Like, it's crazy. So it's a super loaded question then. What do the two of you think that means? Like, what is the opportunity for a community financial institution? Where can they kind of step up to the plate, and where can they start to actually have an impact for the positive here?
Well, you know, I think that there's the area that I can speak best to is just this opportunity to deepen relationships and to be a real ally in sort of the financial decision-making process for folks, whether it's they want to buy a home or they want to buy a car, something that they telegraph that clearly a financial institution can help with, to, you know, something that's more out there as far as, like, you know, I want to be able to plan for retirement, like something that's more of a planning function. And so I think that there's real value in enabling those conversations more easily and being able to do it in a digital realm, to have a process around that, to be able to connect them with people who can really help them, that whose job is to help them, right? And to facilitate that relationship partly through technology, but also partly through the real person who's helping. And I think in my mind, and sort of in the research that we've done, that this idea of being able to start people in an asynchronous way, to be able to help them start to dip their toe in the water and get some value from some interactions, and then be able to make the decision to go deeper if they want to, is, I think there's a lot of value in that for financial institutions, particularly ones that are focused on the community and whose a lot of the value is really in being an advocate for individuals, for their members, for their customers. And so developing that relationship, and it's getting harder to do that because people are showing up less and less in the branch. So I think in my mind that advice, when people tell you what their financial goals are, it gives you an opening to have that conversation that's much more broad and it aligns with where they want to go and what they want to get accomplished. And I think that sort of that goals-based focus that Sid was just referring to is important, because that's what we ultimately care about, right? Like, why do we work? We work so that we can do the things that are important to us, right? And not just for the sake of work necessarily. And so I think keying in on that and being able to facilitate meaning behind that is going to be important.
That's it.
Yeah. I also think that as it becomes easier and easier and easier to spend money, there's going to become more and more appetite for spending controls, for what we call, you know, pre-commitment devices, you know, a separation of money into different pockets within a digital system. And I think that is already something that we're seeing people turn to, but they're turning to it outside of a financial institution. So we hear people saying, you know, I've
opened up a bank with my spouse or with my mother, we both have to be there in person to make withdrawals from that account. Things like that. There's an appetite for spending controls. The issue is that people really don't like being told what to do with their own money. So it's really tricky for a financial institution to say, hey, we're going to prevent you from withdrawing cash. Even if that's something that you really desire, really, really hard to get to take that from a financial institution. So I think that, you know, to Matt's point, building that trust with the financial institution is going to be key in allowing those, you know, those spending controls, those, you know, alternatives to the traditional checking and savings account, those smarter divisions of money, allowing those to be created and to be used by consumers in a way that doesn't feel paternalistic and a little controlling. It's really going to be trust that's sort of at the bottom of making those work.
And Sid, I feel like I know the answer to this, but I want to ask it so that you can answer much more eloquently than I ever would be able to. So looking at it from a behavioral research standpoint, mm-hmm. Do you think that there is an opportunity to actually make large-scale behavioral changes in our society and influence people to make better financial decisions?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, we're making large-scale behavioral design choices in our society that are influencing people to make poorer financial decisions. So the reverse is true. And we do partner with a lot of folks who have sway in the financial world, who are, you know, invested in helping people make healthy financial decisions. And I think it takes a little bit of looking beyond the next quarter's worth of earnings, and taking a longer view of a company's success and realizing that, you know, there are many, many ways in which a financially healthy consumer can contribute to the health of the organization that's serving them. I think that's where.
Finish your thoughts. Sorry. Oh. No, it just made me think about it differently than I think I maybe have ever like said out loud, but I think we're seeing a great example of that right now, right? Like we went through a great time of economic prosperity here in America and we were spending like it was going out of style. And now we're heading into a recession, right? Or kind of experiencing a recession, and we're starting to see the Fed increase interest rates and starting to try and do things to tampen that down. And we're starting to see big tech companies do big layoffs. And so, yeah, that's great if you make it so easy for people to spend their money to buy your products. But if all of a sudden they don't have any money to spend and your company goes out of business because nobody's buying anything at all, like short-term gain for long-term failure, right? So I think that's a great point, Sid, of just even companies should be thinking about motivating consumers to make smart financial decisions so they can continue to buy their products from them for forever.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, you know, with more and more and more institutions, like, you know, talk about having 15, you know, fintechs on your phone, it's going to be more important to build that loyalty to your product. And I think that, you know, like giving the correct impression that you are looking out for your client, for your customer, is going to be huge in producing that loyalty that leads them to choose you over your competitor.
Yeah. This has been absolutely fascinating, the two of you. I could probably keep you till the cows come home. But before I let you go, I have two final questions for you. So Sid, maybe we'll start with you. Where do you go to get information? That's a loaded question for a researcher. Like, I don't know if we have another 5 hours for you to give us all your sources, but I don't know, maybe some of the top places you like to go to get information about what's happening in our industry.
I mean, honestly, the honest answer to this question is not very satisfying, because the main place that I go to get my research is my lab. So this lab is incredible at sharing resources. We have journal clubs every week. We, you know, have discussions over lunch about new articles. So the vast majority of what I get comes from my coworkers. And then, you know, of course, I follow couple different, you know, major newspapers. I have a giant folder of journals that just, you know, get filtered straight to my inbox. So every day I'm getting newsletters. But I think that the honestly, for me, the true answer is starting conversations with coworkers, starting conversations with, you know, the people in your network and asking them what they've been most excited about recently. And I find that, you know, when I engage in those conversations with the people around me, I come out with not only new research, but with perspectives on that research that are not my own. And I find that really, really valuable.
Well, that's going to be a great lead into my next question for you. But before I do, Matt, what about for yourself? Where do you go to get information about what's happening in our industry?
Yeah, you know, I'd sort of reading what research the Common Sense Lab and Center for Advanced Hindsight's put out, one of the things that's been really productive is just reaching out to people on LinkedIn and having conversations, people who are like-minded, and just having conversations around what they're working on, what they're finding interesting. Like, that's always, I mean, and that maybe only happens a couple of times a week, but that's always really interesting for me personally. And then a couple of places I mostly focus on fintech. So I really like Alex Johnson's newsletter. I think it's called Fintech Takes. And he's got a really great writing voice and also some really good insight that really sort of cuts through some of the BS that is very, this sector can be very prone towards. And then also Nicole Kasperson, who writes Fintech is Femme, is also has a really good point of view around bringing in voices that aren't traditionally centered in sort of in how we think about fintech. So I think those are really good can't miss options as far as I'm concerned.
Awesome. And then, so Sid, if people want to learn more about the research that you've been doing, or maybe even see some of the research, how do they find what you've been working on?
Yeah, well, in a couple of weeks, you can probably ask Google's chatbot to take you to my home address. But if you Google Center for Advanced Hindsight, or if you want to do it the old-fashioned way, you can go to advanced-hindsight.com, and you'll find information about all of the work that the lab is doing. You can find my profile there and a way to contact me at the lab. But that's a pretty easy Google.
And we'll have links to that on the webpage for the podcast as well.
That is even easier.
Yeah. And then Matt, if people want to connect with you and learn more about you and what you're working on, I think you and I actually met through a random LinkedIn conversation. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say LinkedIn's probably a good place to find you.
LinkedIn's good. Yeah. Matt@moneymap.io is also good. But either of those are good options.
Awesome. Well, thank you both. Again, this has been absolutely fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time to spend with me. Thanks for being guests on the Digital Banking Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
It's so much fun.
Thank you for listening to the Digital Banking Podcast powered by Typhoon. Find more episodes on digitalbankingpodcast.com or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Typhoon. Everyone builds features. Not everyone builds relationships. We build both.